Welcome to Oh My God, I'm Getting Older and So Is My Mom with Scott Greenberg of Comfort Care Senior Services, a show about coping with getting older ourselves and dealing with our aging parents. If you have questions about how to cope with these stresses, call Scott at 877-960-9960. Now, here's Scott.
Welcome, everybody, another edition of Oh My God, I'm Getting Older and So Is My Mom. We're here tonight on 95.9 and 106.9 FM. Yes, the area's number one rated radio station with adult listeners. We're really excited to be part of this growing story, and we're glad that you're with us. The weather's not been that good today, so if you're on 95 or on the turnpike, please be careful. It's pretty nasty out there, although at the moment it looks pretty nice. Most of you may or may not be aware that May is Stroke Awareness Month, and tonight's show just might save your life if you are ever confronted with the prospects of being affected by a stroke. My guest is perhaps the foremost authority on strokes in our area. We're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about what we were talking about right before the show came on. We're going to talk about aneurysms, and I know people are very concerned about that. But Dr. Ali Malik is here, and hopefully you never need to meet him. If you have a stroke, you want to meet him because he is as good as it gets, and I'll tell you more about him in just a second. But first, a few announcements. If you live on the Treasure Coast and want to know how this road that we're traveling down is a little different than we anticipated, it is not necessarily that sail down the intracoastal with the wind through our hair and a glass of red wine in our hand. I'm going to be speaking and tell you about what you can expect and what you should prepare for. I'm going to be speaking this Thursday at Regency Park Senior Living in Vero Beach. I'll be there at noon. You can call them at 772-770-1228 for more information and to reserve your spot. Also, I mentioned that I will, along with my son-in-law, we will be conducting a five-week workshop on dementia and Alzheimer's beginning Friday, June 1st at 2 o'clock at Barrington Terrace. And I'm not sure if Barrington Terrace is in Boynton or Del Rey, but it's right on the on the dividing line between Boynton and Del Rey. I encourage you to find out more information. It'll be five Fridays in a row. The last Friday will be Dr. David Watson, who will be talking about the latest in research and development in the clinical trial arena. Dr. Watson is Alzheimer's Research and Treatment Center. He is also one of the top 10, if not one of the top five researchers in the United States, and he's in our area. Also, for those who are looking for a support group, we're going to be starting a new Alzheimer's support group at Artists Assisted Living on May 30th at 4 o'clock. Artists is a great memory care-specific assisted living. We encourage you to join us. Take a tour of their community if you like, but you don't have to. And you can talk to other family members dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia. But now to my guest, which is why I hope you're listening tonight. Dr. Ali Malik is the Director of Neurointerventional Program and Comprehensive Stroke Program at St. Mary's Medical Center. He clearly is an interventional neurologist, board certified in neurology, vascular neurology, and neurocritical care, as well as endovascular neurosurgery. And just so you know, he did his residency at the University of South Florida. He did his fellowship at the University of Alabama, and also at Providence Hospital in Southfield, Michigan. Dr. Malik, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm well. Thank you.
So I think we ought to start kind of at the most basic. Can we describe what a stroke is? Because I think people don't really know what a stroke is.
So our brain is made up of brain cells or neurons. When neurons die because of a lack of blood flow, that is a stroke. And that can be, the lack of blood flow can be because of a blockage in a blood vessel or breakage of a blood vessel where there's leakage of blood out and so the brain cells don't get it. But essentially, anytime brain cells die because of a change in blood flow, that's a stroke.
Is it always an emergency situation, or
yes,
is it not always?
It is always an emergency situation. If you have a blockage in a major blood vessel in your brain, you will literally start losing about 1.9 to 2 million brain cells every minute that goes by. And brain cells die within anywhere from a minute and a half to 3 minutes of lack of blood flow. So time is the key factor here. We have lots of blood vessels that are trying to make up for the major blockages, which is why we have a time to give drugs and try to open things up. But essentially, the sooner you get help, the less brain damage you'll sustain.
So I hear people all the time talk about it. My mother-in-law, may she rest in peace, used to talk about mini strokes, TIAs. Are they strokes, or are they something different than strokes, or are they a degree of stroke?
So people like using different terms for things, and the reality is I would like everyone to think about any sudden change in their brain function because of a lack of blood flow or a change in blood flow as a stroke. If you call something a mini stroke, that kind of undermines the severity of it. But what's mini? So for example, if you had a stroke that affected the movement of your right hand, well, if you're left-handed, I guess that's minier than the other side. Or if you have a stroke that makes you forget what it was like to have your Italian grandmother's, you know, pasta when you were five, you know, is that a mini stroke? Yeah, compared to being paralyzed and unable to speak, but it's still losing brain cells. And the reality is that the concept of a mini stroke is one that I think undermines the reality that strokes are an emergency and should be treated as quickly as possible, and there is nothing mini or trivial about them. Now, TIA, a transient ischemic attack, is a technical medical term for a very specific subtype, and nothing is a TIA. It's always a stroke until it's proven to not be a stroke after the fact. So if you have a change in the blood flow to a portion of your brain and your brain stops functioning for a few minutes, the most common TIAs are where you get weak on one side and you lose vision in an eye, and it's because of a blockage in a carotid. If that happens, but then that blockage suddenly opens up because you break down the clot on your own, and this goes away in under 3 minutes or 5 minutes, then that's probably a TIA in that it is likely that you dodged major brain cells from dying. But I'm willing to bet if we had the technology to look and count every single brain cell, that you would find some brain cells still died with that, and so it is still technically a stroke.
So can a TIA, mini stroke, a major stroke, clearly, and we're going to talk about signs, I get that. We are, and we'll talk about warning signs. For those of you who are listening, I promise you we're going to talk about warning signs, we're going to talk about aneurysms. Can you diagnose a TIA or a mini stroke, and I know I'm not supposed to use them interchangeably, I understand that. I can see you shaking your head. Can you diagnose those after the fact?
In fact, the only way to actually diagnose a TIA is after the fact.
After the fact.
And that's where somebody looks like they're having a stroke, and we give them a clot-busting drug, or we open up the blood vessel, and everything goes well. And then when we scan their brain, we don't see signs of a stroke. That was a TIA. But if you see signs of a stroke and the deficit is small and that the person is doing really well, they might unfortunately call it a mini stroke, but it's still a stroke.
Right.
The thing is, so most of our cells in our body, they reproduce, they rejuvenate, they recover. Not cells from our heart, not cells from our brain. So brain cells, while we do grow some as we get older, the amount that we grow is incredibly small. And for every 10,000 brain cells you lose, if you regain one of them, that really doesn't make up for the damage that's done. So we treat heart cells and brain cells as irrecoverable cells. And so that's why a stroke, no matter how small or how large, is considered a significant emergency.
So through that, I have now 30 new questions that just came up. But I'll start with, because I think this is most important, because this is, after all, Stroke Awareness Month. What constitutes a sign that you might, in fact, be having a stroke?
So look at who you are right this moment, what you can do and what you can't do. Any sudden change from this is potentially a stroke. So if right now you can look to the left and look to the right and you see normally, and then all of a sudden, 5 minutes from now, you look to the left and you see double, that is a stroke until proven otherwise. If you suddenly have difficulty finding words when normally you have no trouble doing so, that is a stroke until proven otherwise. these are things that, you know, people kind of take for granted. Everyone knows about FAST, right? So face, so if you have asymmetry of your face that's new and sudden, so facial droop on one side or the other. If you have arm or leg weakness that's sudden, that's new, those are potentially signs of a stroke. If you have changes in your speech, either difficulty understanding or difficulty expressing yourself, that's the S for FAST. And then T stands for time, which again emphasizes that time is brain. But if you think that something suddenly has changed in you that wasn't like that before. So, for example, you're doing fine, and all of a sudden your right arm and your right leg feel heavy. Well, that is a stroke until proven otherwise, and that means call 911. Do not drive yourself. Do not ask your significant other or your friend next door to drive you. 911, get to the hospital, because that, even though it may be mild right now, in half an hour, in an hour, in 2 hours, may become something much, much worse. The worst thing that anyone can do is say, I don't feel really right, but I'm just going to go to sleep and see if I get better by tomorrow. Because if they get to us soon enough, we have medications, we have techniques and tools that will potentially open blockages of blood vessels, and somebody that's having a massive stroke can go back to having a completely normal life, but all they've got to do is go to bed and wait until the next day, and they will essentially, if they're lucky, die. If they're unlucky, end up paralyzed and unable to speak and comprehend at a nursing home.
So I understand, and I know that you do too, because we've talked about this before and I've talked about it with others. There is an unbelievable reluctance to pick up the phone and call 911. We don't want to bother anybody. Exactly what you said. I'll go to sleep. I'll see how I feel in the morning. Everything will be okay. I won't put words in your mouth, but time is brain, and nothing could be further from the right thing to do, right? I mean, that's what 911 is supposed to do.
There is no bigger bother than ending up in a nursing home unable to actually function when it was preventable. So, yeah, our colleagues in EMS are phenomenal. They want to do what's best for you, and not one of them will say, oh, why did he or she call us? Why did we take them to the emergency room? It was nothing serious. They're going to be grateful to know that they brought somebody in and they figured out that something was fixable or that nothing needed to be done. That's great, you know. But any sudden change, think about it. There has to be a reason for it. And if you don't know what the reason is, it needs to be figured out pretty urgently.
You know, I confess to being guilty, as I'm sure many are. I had dinner the other night, and I wasn't sure if I was holding my cell phone funny or whatever, but I sat down to the restaurant. All of a sudden, I had a weakness in my arm and my left, and I was not sure if I should call 911. In hindsight, I probably should have called 911. I didn't, and I did feel better, and it was that I was holding my phone in a funny manner. But, you know, again, the other side of that is there was one time I thought I was having a heart attack. So I drove myself to the hospital, and on the way to the hospital, I got to the hospital. I said, you know, I think I'm having a heart attack. And of course, it's like the Jetsons. Things started flying out of the ceiling. But I did. I had a blockage, and it was the right thing to do at that moment.
But not driving yourself.
Yeah,
because
no way.
In all honesty, so when EMS brings you in, you also get triaged differently.
Right.
So you will get care quicker if EMS knows that they think you're having a stroke. We're prepared. My team is there. We get ready to do all the things that we need to do. Well, if you just show up in the emergency room, it's going to take a little while to get everything up and running. So it is always better to have EMS involved. Now, one key point, though, for the neurologic change, for the thing that's different, is how sudden it occurs. So typically, you know, if something is slow and gradual in onset, it is a little bit, I don't want to say less concerning. It's a different concern than if it's as if a switch went off. If 1 minute you are playing piano and the next minute you can't move your right hand, that's a serious problem. If you're holding your phone for a while and then after you've been, you know, doing something for a while, you find that you're having a little bit of clumsiness and all that, that may be a little bit different and may not have the same level of concern. But still, when in doubt, why take the risk? You need to be checked out.
So the other question before I move on to different kinds of strokes, we've talked about some and we move into aneurysm. Where you go matters too. And if you think you're having a stroke, and I know EMS, they're fabulous. They can pretty much determine whether this is more serious or not. Can they redirect you to a hospital that, like you, that is more experienced in treating stroke, or are all emergency rooms able to do emergency triage?
So actually, by law now, EMS in Florida will preferentially take you to a stroke center. And in more cases than not, they'll take you to a comprehensive stroke center versus a primary stroke center if there's an option. I think that everyone should be aware of which hospitals are in their community and what the level of stroke care is. It's easy to put a billboard up and say, hey, we're the best stroke center.
Right.
But it makes a big difference if somebody comes to your emergency room and they're given IV TPA, which is the clot busting drug, and they're given it within 10 minutes of arrival versus within 2 hours of arrival. You know, you're going to want to go to the place that you know that has the better statistics, that does a good job. EMS knows that better than anyone else, and so they will typically try to direct you to the places that they would want their own family member to go. But, you know, as time goes by, I think you'll find more of that data available publicly as well. But, yes, you want to go to a stroke center. You want to go to a comprehensive stroke center if there's the possibility that you need somebody like me to pull a clot outside of a blood vessel in a brain. And any delays that occur do potentially reduce your risk of having a good outcome. Having said that, it is more important that you get somewhere, because most hospitals can give the clot-busting drug. And, for example, we had a patient last night, went to one hospital that was the closest to them, got the clot-busting drug. As the clot-busting drug was still flowing, they came to our hospital. We pulled two clots out of the blood vessels of the brain, and they're doing fantastic. So it's important for people to just get care.
And so that's another question that I have, which is, how prevalent is stroke? And so that's the first part of the question. How prevalent is stroke? Does it affect a limited number of people? I know you're busy, so it affects a lot of people. But
so every year, almost 800,000 Americans have a stroke.
Wow.
That's a lot. And the reality is that if anyone listening thinks that they do not have risk factors for stroke, because let's say that they're listening with their grandfather right now and they're 15, we've treated 11-year-olds, 7-year-olds,
yeah, this is not an age-related I mean, it is obviously more
as you get older.
Right,
as you get older, your risks for stroke increase and your chances of having a stroke go up. But there is nobody that is alive that doesn't have some risk factor for stroke. And there are things that people can do to make their risk of stroke go up. And there are things that we can do that will make our risk for stroke go down. But the reality is that everyone should know what their risk factors are, do whatever they can to reduce them. And the most important thing is to know what the signs and symptoms of a stroke are, and recognize that, you know, even though they don't want to be the person having a stroke, that it is possible that those symptoms that they're having right now are a stroke and they should get help.
The clot busting drug that you talked about, that has been a game changer over the last few years, correct?
So IV recombinant tissue plasminogen activator, or IV RTPA, has been instrumental in helping open up blood vessels. It really did revolutionize actually the entire field of neurology. Neurology, before clot-busting drugs, when it came to stroke, really had nothing as a tool to treat stroke. We only had tools to prevent strokes. The TPA gave us the first tool to treat strokes. But much more revolutionary were the big studies in 2015 that showed the things that we've been doing for a decade, which involve actually removing clots from the blood vessels of the brain, have the biggest impact on stroke. So while the clot-busting drug is a good start, it really has been what we call mechanical thrombectomy, or removing a clot mechanically from the blood vessels of the brain, has been the true revolution.
So if you're just tuning in, it's Scott Greenberg. Oh, my God, I'm getting older. So is my mom. And if you have been listening, you know that I am talking with Dr. Ali Malik. Dr. Malik is one of the foremost authorities on stroke. He is an interventional neurologist, is the director of the neurointerventional program at St. Mary's Hospital and the Comprehensive Stroke Program. For those of you who have ever had any thing to do with Dr. Malik and his program, you know that his reputation is unsurpassed. May being Stroke Awareness Month, I can't thank Dr. Malik enough for being here tonight. We have a whole lot more to talk about. If you have questions for Dr. Malik or for me, you can call us at 1-877-960-9960. That's 1-877-960-9960.
I'm here with Allison from Comfort Care Senior Services. Allison, at Comfort Care, you guys are proud to be a family-owned and operated business.
That's right, Mike. It's myself and my husband, Tino, my sister, Melissa, and her husband, Joe, and my parents, Irene and Scott Greenberg. As you can tell by six family members being able to work together, family is extremely important to us. Our clients often have kids that live out of state or even overseas, and those extended family members want to have the comfort of being able to contact a family member at any time to follow up on how mom or dad is doing. While you are able to reach a family member at any time, our office staff is truly part of our extended family. They monitor the phones 24/7 in case of an emergency and are empowered to make decisions that are in the best interest of the client, because at Comfort Care, it's the quality of care, not the severity of your condition, that determines the quality of life. Call us at 561-630-1620. That's 561-630-1620, or visit our website at palmbeach.comfortcare.com. That's palmbeach.comfortcare.com.
Do your parents live in South Florida? We know it can be difficult to be there for them when you live far away. As mom and dad get older, things can change in an instant. Are you prepared? Finding a trusted local expert to coordinate and provide care makes all the difference. Eldercare 360 can provide you and your family the proper guidance, support, and education to resolve everyday issues that can impact healthcare challenges and more. As a patient advocate, Eldercare 360 brings together decades of experience as patient-focused professionals to assist you and your families with their routine activities of living and healthcare challenges. Being proactive is the best way to ensure the best possible outcome for you and your family during these times. Call us to see how we can help before the crisis at 561-713-1800. Make Eldercare 360 part of your team. Eldercare 360, patient advocacy, coordination of services, and full circle of care. 561-713-1800.
I'm here with Melissa from Comfort Care Senior Services. Melissa, caregiver stress is a real condition and it's becoming an epidemic.
That's right, Mike. Chronic diseases like Parkinson's, MS, Alzheimer's, cancer, among others, affect more than just the person with the diagnosis. They affect the entire family, oftentimes putting added stress on the primary family caregiver. In fact, 64% of family caregivers who do not seek outside help will predecease their loved one living with Alzheimer's disease. Even just a few hours of respite care a week can give someone a much-needed break so that they can be the best caregiver they can be. Whether it's time to schedule a hair appointment, a card game, an exercise class, or lunch with friends. Remember, it's the quality of care, not the severity of one's condition, that determines their quality of life. Let our family take care of your family. Call us at 561-630-1620. That's 561-630-1620.
Welcome back to Oh My God, I'm Getting Older and So Is My Mom with Scott Greenberg of Comfort Care Senior Services. Reach Scott with your questions, 877-960-9960. Now, back to Scott.
All right, let's see what she has to ask us. Hey, everybody, we're back. Oh, my God, I'm getting older. So is my mom. I should be paying better attention, and we don't have any dead air. We did have a caller, and I'm going to answer that question in just a little bit. They didn't want to come on the air, so I'm getting that. But before I do, we're all talking about strokes. We are here with Dr. Ali Malik from St. Mary's Medical Center, the Comprehensive Stroke Program. He is the director of neurointerventional of the Neurointerventional Program and the Comprehensive Stroke Program at St. Mary's. If you're listening on 95.9 or on 106.9, we're live on Monday night. We're glad that you're with us. If you're new, this is Oh My God, I'm Getting Older, So Is My Mom. We're here every Monday night live. We talk about a whole host of different issues. Tonight's is most important because it is Stroke Awareness Month, and we are, in fact, talking about strokes. Before the break, we were talking about TIAs. We were talking about mini strokes. We were talking about 911, defining strokes, and looking for early warning signs. But before I get into the aneurysm, which I know everybody wants to talk about, Dr. Malik, what are the risk factors for strokes? What are people? What should people be looking at?
So pretty much anything that affects the blood vessels increases your risk for stroke. So some things are controllable. For example, whether or not you have high blood pressure, whether or not you smoke, Please, if you smoke, please. Stop. That's the single most preventable cause of strokes and heart attacks, and something that you're doing to yourself. But if you have high blood pressure, and by the way, if you haven't measured your blood pressure, you probably have high blood pressure. You should get it checked. You should check it, and you should talk to your doctor about being treated. The guidelines have changed as to what we consider as being too high. People say, well, my blood pressure's, it's in the 160s, but it's only like that, maybe 2 or 3 days a week. For every minute, if your heart beats 70 times a minute, your blood is pounding into the blood vessels at that higher number, in that 160 or whatever, and that damages the blood vessels. So anything that damages the blood vessels is a risk factor. Probably the single biggest risk factor after high blood pressure and smoking that people don't recognize is being sedentary. So the more time we spend not moving, the sooner we'll stop moving forever. And that's something that most people don't realize. Obesity is a consequence of that. But more important than anything else is physical activity and being able to be essentially as active as you can be. It doesn't matter how old you are. You should be as active as you're capable of being. If you just sit and watch TV, not only will you melt your brain, but you'll also die sooner from being sedentary. And that's really important. You need to know what your risk factors are that are personal to you, things you can't change. Older you get, the greater your risk of stroke. If you're a guy, you have a slightly higher risk. Different races have slightly different risks. If a first-degree family relative, your mother, father, brother, sister, or child had a stroke, your risk is higher. Those are things that you can't change, but the things you can change. If you have diabetes, how well your blood sugar is controlled, that makes a difference. If you have high blood pressure, how well your blood pressure is controlled, that makes a difference. How active you are, that makes a difference. If you have an irregular heartbeat, whether or not you're on the correct blood thinner to help protect you from clots coming from your heart, that makes a difference. These are things that each person should talk about with their doctor. There are different clotting abnormalities that people can have. Some of them run into families. Some of them can manifest in other ways. So the single most important thing is see your doctor, ask your questions.
Those are all really interesting. Do we have one of the things you didn't mention, previous cardiac events, stents. So like, I have a stent. So
any problem stents with a blood vessel? So this is kind of like, I think the last time we talked, we used the analogy of the light bulb in the new house.
Right.
If you build a new house and 2 years later a light bulb burns out, you kind of know you may need to replace all of your light bulbs. Likewise, if you have a heart attack, or a stroke. If you have any kind of blood vessel event that has to do with a blockage in a blood vessel, odds are the rest of your blood vessels aren't that healthy either. And so people need to look at their risk factors even closer when they've had a heart attack or if they've had chest pain and things like that. So cholesterol being high, it affects not just the heart, but the brain as well.
Okay. So the caller who called in who is shy, right, who is afraid, she's having numbness in her left leg and trouble remembering things. Sometimes she blacks out and she has to remember what she was doing. And is that a sign of a stroke or is that the sign of something else?
It can be, but this isn't normal, so she should definitely get it checked out.
Right.
I mean, numbness is a potential manifestation of a stroke, but it's also a manifestation of other things, such as diabetes, such as B12 deficiency, such as a list that would fill a textbook. Memory problems. Memory problems can come for many reasons. And I think that one of the biggest errors people make is that they make excuses for memory problems. They think that memory problems are okay as we get older. If you have a change in your memory, right, or other people notice a change in your memory, you need to see a specialist in memory problems. It is important.
Right. We have another caller and another question, so we'll go to Pamis. Pamis, welcome to the show. What can we do for you?
I just have a question, what you know about
I guess we don't have
AV.
I think we lost him. Okay, well, anyway, we'll try to find him. We'll take a break at this moment. If you're just tuning in, it's, again, Scott. Oh, it's Pam. That's why we were looking. Pam is on the line, not Pamis. all right. Pam, are you there?
I am.
Pam, this is Scott Greenberg. How are you tonight?
I'm great, Scott. How are you?
I'm well. You have a question for Dr. Malik?
Yes, I just wondered what Dr. Malik knew. I had a stroke about 4 years ago, and I was told by St. Mary's, they didn't know why I had a hemorrhagic stroke, actually, why I bled, and I guess I didn't understand why I was quite young at the time, you know, to have just had a stroke. So they told, I did find out that I had an AVM. You know, arterial venous malformation, and I've had it since birth. So could I have more that would just all of a sudden bleed?
So arterial venous malformations, AVMs. So kind of to defend my colleagues at St. Mary's, or myself if it was me, we do know why you bled. You had an AVM. Arterial venous malformations are a blood vessel abnormality that manifests potentially. You have about a 2% per year chance of it bleeding. Did we fix your AVM?
Actually, no. I had it diagnosed at another hospital, Miami, is where I had to go.
So
I was sent home without that diagnosis.
Okay. So when an AVM ruptures, if it's surrounded by blood, because it's a blood vessel abnormality, it can be invisible for a while. So our normal protocol is to help somebody get through the hemorrhage, the type of stroke that they had, the bleeding stroke that they had, and then they're supposed to follow up with us so we can actually do imaging. Because as the blood resorbs, the underlying cause for it, if it's not because of high blood pressure, if it's because of an aneurysm or an AVM, it will show up as the blood goes away. So we never give up on somebody just because we didn't find a reason for their bleeding, but we do wait until the blood goes away and re-image them with MRIs, with contrast, and a bunch of other studies. But I'm glad that you had your AVM diagnosed. Arterial venous malformations are a relatively rare cause of bleeding and a rare cause of stroke, but they do happen. They're in one in about 100,000 people. People are typically born with them. There are characteristics that will increase your risk of bleeding from them. But in general, if you were to look at all AVMs, about a 2% chance per year of them causing a problem. That does not mean that in 50 years you have a 100% chance. That means every year you roll a 100-sided die, and if you roll a 1 or a 2, then you bleed. So people go through their entire lives never being diagnosed with their AVM, and people go through their entire lives never having re-hemorrhages. But there are characteristics associated with AVMs that can be higher risk and will make us more likely to want to fix them. Things like aneurysms within the nidus, stenoses in the veins that drain them, etc. So sorry that we didn't get a chance to help you, but I'm glad that you got your diagnosis.
And I want to thank you for calling. And if you have any questions, I'm going to ask Dr. Malik before the end of the program to give out the contact information for his office. And it would be great for you to follow up then. But I appreciate you listening. I appreciate you calling. Thank you, and have a good night.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So I guess since we got a couple of calls, why don't we take a break, come back, and we'll talk about the things we want to talk about, which are the subtypes, which is one you were just talking about, and then we can move into aneurysms. If you're just tuning in, Scott Greenberg, Oh My God, I'm Getting Older, So Is My Mom, here tonight with Dr. Ali Malik. Obviously a very popular guy. I get a lot of calls tonight to talk about strokes during May, Stroke Awareness Month. If you have any more questions, you can call us at 1-877-960-9960. 1-877-960-9960.
I'm here with Tino from Comfort Care Senior Services. Tino, you train all of your caregivers on how to deal with those who are struggling with Alzheimer's disease, right?
I do, Mike. This disease process is frightening for everyone, and change is the scariest thing for most people. Where we should start is changing the way we think. People are not dying from Alzheimer's disease. They are living with it, and we have to figure out a way for them to keep on living their best life possible. I always say activities of daily living keep people alive. Meaningful activities is what gives people a life worth living. Properly training caregivers on all sorts of dementia is very important. Learning about behavior modification techniques, avoiding triggers, tapping into the abilities that are preserved the longest with people with dementia, and figuring out what's important to them are all vital tools caregivers need to understand. Remember, it's about the quality of care, not the severity of one's condition that determines their quality of life. Let our family take care of your family. Call us at 561-630-1620 or visit us on the web at palmbeach.comfortcare.com.
I'm here with Allison from Comfort Care Senior Services. Allison, at Comfort Care, you guys really look at every client differently.
Activities of daily living keep people alive. Meaningful activities give people a life worth living. That's why at Comfort Care, we complete a social history for our clients. It taps into one's life story to help caregivers know more about who this person was and, quite frankly, still is. It asks questions like, what did you do for a living? What volunteer work did you do? What was your favorite book or movie? Were you in the military? And the list goes on. Understanding background like this is helpful in creating meaningful activities. For example, if someone was a cartographer in the Army, perhaps a trip to the library to look at old maps of where they were stationed might be an interesting activity. If someone were an avid golfer, perhaps a makeshift putting green might be a fun outing. We couple that with a day in the life, which asks more of the daily routine questions, so a caregiver coming in is already familiar with the schedule. It makes the adjustment to having a caregiver that much easier. Caregivers want to help their clients live their best life possible. Being armed with the right information can help, because at Comfort Care, it's the quality of care, not the severity of one's condition, that determines your quality of life. Call us at 561-630-1620. That's 561-630-1620.
Welcome back to Oh My God, I'm Getting Older and So Is My Mom with Scott Greenberg of Comfort Care Senior Services. Reach Scott with your questions, 877-960-9960. Now, back to Scott.
Welcome back, everybody. We're glad that you're with us. Dr. Ali Malik is here. Dr. Malik is the Director of Neurointerventional and Comprehensive of the Neurointerventional and Comprehensive Stroke Program at St. Mary's Medical Center. He is perhaps the foremost authority on strokes in our area. So if you're listening on 95.9 FM in Palm Beach, while you don't ever want to meet him, if you need him, you really want to meet him, because he's as good as it gets. And of course, if you're on the Treasure Coast, we are glad that you are with us as well. If you're listening on Long Island, it's Wednesday night. You obviously will never get to meet Dr. Malik, but maybe you have family down here who might. So I encourage you to listen. This is a very important show. Dr. Malik, before the break, we got a call. We had a couple of calls. But one call described something I didn't know anything about, and I still don't really understand it, an AVM. So there are subtypes of strokes. Can we identify some of the subtypes?
So there's two main categories. It's either an ischemic stroke, which is due to a blockage of a blood vessel, or a hemorrhagic stroke, which is due to rupture of a blood vessel or bleeding. Each one of those then has subtypes as defined by the cause. Each one has the most common versions. So when it comes to ischemic strokes, we talk about why did the blood vessel get blocked off and what size blood vessel got blocked off. So if a large vessel is blocked off, it could be because of, like in a heart attack, you have plaque buildup, you have basically crud buildup, and the crud suddenly breaks off a little lining of the blood vessel and clot forms and it blocks off the blood vessel, or a clot forms and goes downstream and blocks off a blood vessel. In small vessel strokes, what you have is essentially because of high blood pressure, smoking, diabetes, etc., the tiny blood vessels in the brain kind of get calloused, for want of a better word, and they get thicker and thicker and less blood flows through them, and that causes small strokes, but potentially in very eloquent areas. So you could also have strokes coming in the form of clots coming from the heart or coming from blood vessels in the legs or in the pelvis if there's a hole in the heart. So there's a number of different reasons you can have an ischemic stroke or the stroke where there's a blockage. When it comes to bleeding in the brain, which is another type of stroke, we define it, one, by the location of the blood. Is the blood inside the brain tissue itself, or is it in the lining of the brain or right outside of the brain? And the other one is, again, what's the cause? So cerebral hemorrhage or bleeding in the brain, the most common cause of it is high blood pressure. But occasionally we get young patients that don't have high blood pressure, or we have older patients that don't have high blood pressure, and we need to figure out why the blood is there. So one type of bleeding in the lining of the brain is called subarachnoid hemorrhage. That's from an aneurysm that can bleed, or from an AVM, which you just heard about, which is a blood vessel abnormality. AVMs are interesting, but they're very rare, and right. It is because of their anatomy and their morphology. When they cause bleeding, a lot of times the diagnosis doesn't occur until after the blood has resorbed a bit, because these blood vessels kind of squish themselves when the blood is there. It kind of tamponades and compresses the blood vessels. Aneurysms are common. If you took 100 of us randomly, anywhere from 2 to 6 of us have an aneurysm in our brain. That's a lot of aneurysms. Again, 2 to 6% of the American population has an aneurysm, which is a little bubble in a blood vessel in their brain. only one in 600 aneurysms actually bleeds. So aneurysms are common, and aneurysms bleeding are relatively uncommon. The problem is that when they do bleed, 50% of people pretty much die. And right. of the people that survive, a lot of them are very severely disabled. And so everyone's terrified of aneurysms. But in the old days, the only way you could fix aneurysms is by opening up the skull and putting a metal clip across the neck of it. And so we typically didn't fix them until they bled or unless something changed that made you think that they were likely to bleed. Nowadays, we can fix them from the inside. We're much more aggressive. Admittedly, we treat the majority of aneurysms we treat probably do not need to be treated, but because none of us have a true crystal ball that tells us what will bleed and what will not, most of us would prefer to have our aneurysm fixed as opposed to not, if that is appropriate. Aneurysms that are too small, aneurysms that have certain shape characteristics make us less likely to treat them. Think about an egg. If an egg is perfectly smooth, you try to crush it in your hand, you can't, but if it has an irregularity, it does. Likewise, irregularities on aneurysms are harbingers of potential rupture, of the chance that they might bleed, while perfectly round aneurysms may be less likely to bleed. The big risk factors for aneurysms are, one, if you're a woman, your risk is slightly higher than a man's. Changing your gender will not change your risk. So while that may be an option for other reasons, I don't recommend it as a treatment for your aneurysm risk. If you have high blood pressure, your risk is probably a little bit higher. If you have a first-degree family relative, mother, father, brother, sister, or child, and they had an aneurysm rupture, then your chances go up by about 10%. If you are a smoker, your chances go up by about 10 times. So there is no greater risk factor for aneurysm rupture than smoking. So, and think about smoking as the equivalent of pouring acid on your blood vessel and making it weaker and weaker. So every cigarette that you smoke potentially will increase your risk of an aneurysm rupturing. For the most part, being as healthy as you can, if you don't have a reason to worry about an aneurysm, you probably shouldn't have to worry about an aneurysm.
So you were talking at length here about brain aneurysms, but Correct. There are other types of aneurysms. How do they differ? I hear about abdominal aneurysms regularly. So, I hear about blood clots in the leg regularly.
So aneurysms specifically are when a blood vessel has a change in its lining that makes it weaker. There are two major kinds of aneurysms. There's a few other subtypes, but the ones that people typically think about are berry or saccular aneurysms. These are the little bubbles in blood vessels, and those are the things that you typically see inside the brain. Fusiform aneurysms are when a blood vessel kind of swells out like a sausage, and that's what you typically see in the aorta. So when you talk about aortic aneurysms, and even the aorta has aneurysms in different locations. If you have a weakness in one of your blood vessels, it is possible that you have a weakness in other blood vessels. But really, the link between, let's say that your father died of an aortic aneurysm, that doesn't necessarily increase your risk that you're going to die from a subarachnoid hemorrhage from an aneurysm in your brain. So they do seem to have some pretty different risk factors and characteristics in the long run. But the fundamentals, high blood pressure and smoking, are the same throughout.
I have a whole host of questions, and as a result, I'm going to skip our last commercial break and keep going. But if you have questions for my guest, I am here with Dr. Ali Malik. You can call us at 877-960-9960. Dr. Malik, so a couple of things. You said something earlier which surprised me a little bit. Going back to blood pressure, and I know I'm jumping around a little bit here, I'm sorry, but you said if your blood pressure is occasionally at 160 as opposed to normally at 120 or 130, that is really worse than people think it is. Can you explain that again so that somebody naive like me could understand that?
So what the blood pressure is measured as is there's two numbers, a systolic and a diastolic. Right. Systolic is when the heart is contracted. It's the high pressure. It's the top number. It's the larger number. Diastolic is at relaxation. So every time your heart beats, your blood pressure, the pressure inside your blood vessels, goes from that low number to the high number and then drops back down to that. So imagine sandblasting your car, or a water hammer, or any kind of big change in pressure, pounding into every blood vessel in your body with an elevated pressure 60, 70, 80 times a minute, depending on your heart rate. This isn't good for you. So the concept of And in the old days, a lot of physicians did have this attitude. Oh, we measured your blood pressure. It's running in the 140s. I think you should exercise a bit, watch your diet, cut back your salt intake, and we'll recheck it in 6 months. No, that is not acceptable. In this day and age, if your blood pressure is outside of parameters, we start you on medication. Not because we like starting medication, but because we like blood pressure being low. The good news is that you can still do all those things. You can still exercise and diet and cut your salt intake. And if you don't need the blood pressure medicine anymore, we love stopping medications. But for every minute that goes by that your blood pressure is elevated, I don't want you to be continuously increasing your risk of strokes and heart attacks and kidney damage and eye damage and everything else that's associated with high blood pressure. So we are much more aggressive about treating blood pressure now than we used to be.
And that would play back to the aneurysm conversation, the fact that if we all have, by normal standards, have some bubbles, big, small, or insignificant, high blood pressure will affect those negatively.
It will, but that is so much smaller an issue than ischemic strokes, than actual damage to the blood vessels, the small blood vessels in your brain. When people talk about, hey, as I got older, my memory got worse, a lot of times when we do an MRI on those people, we see what are called ischemic white matter changes. We see that the brain has sustained a ton of small strokes. That's because of the little blood vessels that are essentially getting thicker and have less blood flow, and most of that is from high blood pressure. So high blood pressure has adverse effects on multiple organ systems, but definitely on the brain throughout the lifetime. The longer you live, the more likely you'll see the manifestations of that.
So earlier you said that you treat aneurysms more aggressively sometimes than is really perhaps necessary. What determines whether you do or do not become proactive in surgical treatment of
those risk factors that we talked about?
Just the risk factors.
So if I, well, those risk factors and the person themselves. So one is, why did I find the aneurysm? If I found the aneurysm because aneurysm got big enough that it actually caused nerve damage and I can see the nerve damage, we need to fix that. If we found the aneurysm incidentally while we were looking for something else, if the aneurysm's fairly large, then I may be more inclined to push for it. But irregularity in the aneurysm, the location of the aneurysm, and the rest of the risk factors that the person has. So all of those help determine the risk and the risk of fixing it. So if the risk of an aneurysm being repaired is very, very low, then it's a lot safer to fix. And I think the decision is always made with the person that has the aneurysm in terms of, you know, how much risk are you willing to take to either have it rupture, which is unlikely in many scenarios, or have it get fixed, which is fairly low risk in the right scenario as well. So it's hard to tell, though. You know, what I never want to do is say, I really don't want to fix this aneurysm and then have them deteriorate and have something happen later on.
Right.
We had an 84-year-old woman that came in because her aneurysm had ruptured, and her doctor had known about her aneurysm for 5 years and had never had a discussion with her about whether or not it should be fixed. They just said, oh, you know, you're in your late 70s, early 80s. I wouldn't fix it. Age is not a determinant for that, because she was fully functional. She was completely normal. And yet, after an aneurysm ruptures, even young patients don't bounce back that easily.
Yeah, I have two friends that have had aneurysms, both women, incidentally, and one had a second. You treated one. What is the treatment? What we didn't talk about treatment at all, really, in terms of stroke, other than the blood clot buster. What are treatments for stroke, and is there only surgical treatment, or is it blood thinner treatment for the aneurysm story?
So treatment for an aneurysm is to essentially stop the blood flow into it. So you can, the old-fashioned way, and still the right way for certain aneurysm subtypes, is surgery, where basically somebody opens up the head, digs down between the lobes of the brain, puts a metal clip across the neck of the aneurysm. I don't do that. That's not my specialty. I have colleagues that I have a lot of faith in, and I send them to, and they do that for the occasional aneurysm that needs that. The other ways to fix it are from the inside. And when you hear the terms coiling or flow diversion or stent-assisted coiling. These are tools that we use where literally from the inside we can actually cut off the blood flow to the aneurysm or rebuild the blood vessel around it so that the aneurysm does not fill anymore. And those are the ways that we fix it. When it comes to ischemic stroke, right. You know, you talked about the clot-busting drug. That is the standard of care in people that meet criteria for it. However, now the current standard of care for anyone that has a large vessel occlusion, that means a major blood vessel in the brain is blocked off. If they have salvageable tissue, if our studies show that there is a chance that by opening it we will help them, we will open it. And we open it from the inside just by going through a blood vessel either in the femoral artery in the leg or in the wrist, and we run catheters up to the blockage and we literally extract the clot with the different tools that we have.
And that is similar to but not exactly like the placing of a stent for a cardiac.
It's similar in the sense that we're using the same highways. So taking a left at Albuquerque and going to the heart, we take a right and we go up to the brain. And the blood vessels that we use are much, much smaller, much more. My dad's an interventional cardiologist, and I would like to think that he trained me to have more finesse than the cardiologists. Just kidding. We actually, my field stands on the shoulder of giants. Interventional neurology and endovascular neurosurgery have learned much of their techniques from the cardiologists, and we're grateful for that.
That's great. So what is the recovery like? Now, obviously, if you take a proactive approach to an aneurysm, that is designed to prevent anything negative from coming. So I'm assuming that recovery may be take some time, but it's pretty much full recovery, I'm guessing.
If there hasn't been any complication from the procedure and if there is no bleeding from the aneurysm, people essentially go back. It's just a procedure. They recover from it very easily. If they've had bleeding in their brain from an aneurysm rupture or any kind of bleeding in the brain, it all comes down to what the damage is done. So if somebody says to you, what will it take to fix the electrical wiring in my house where there's a fire? Well, if the fire was just in the bedroom, then it's a matter of hopefully rebuilding the bedroom and fixing the wiring in that. If the fire was in the fuse box, which is a relay station to the electrical system for the entire house, the damage is far more extensive. And the brain has the same issue in that different parts of the brain have different levels of eloquence. Now, mind you, none of it is useless, and none of it. This whole thing about using 10% of the brain is actually not true. We use all of our brain. We use all of it for many, many things. And if you have a lesion in any part of your brain, if we look at it closely enough, we will see the effects of it. It may be that you have a frontal lesion and it changes your personality, changes your taste in music, your taste in food, how you'll laugh at a joke or not, and whether or not you'll have the intelligence to do things that you used to do before. Other parts will affect your ability to see, to hear, to process information. Every part of the brain is important. Strokes that affect large areas can have large effects, but in some places that large effect may be neglect, hemianopsias, things that you can actually compensate for, while strokes in small areas like in the brainstem, in the thalamus, in the big relay stations, a small stroke can be absolutely devastating and be very hard to recover from. So everyone's recovery is very dependent on how healthy they were beforehand. So the pessimist would say, I need to get as healthy as possible so that when I have my stroke, I can recover as easily as possible. But that is the reality, is right. That the healthier you are, the better you will do. But also the harder you work when you have after you've had your stroke, the better you will do as well. If we just put you in a corner and ignore you, you're probably not going to have a very good recovery. Well, if you have very aggressive therapy, and especially nowadays with virtual reality and augmented reality and all of these incredible tools that we have, you'll probably have a much better recovery, especially if you're given a lot of attention.
So if you just tuned in, this is Scott Greenberg. Oh, my God, I'm getting older. So is my mom. I've been here tonight with Dr. Ali Malik. If you've been listening, you know that he is really quite a special resource in our community as the director of the Neurointerventional and Comprehensive Stroke Program at St. Mary's Medical Center. We've been talking about strokes. We've been talking about aneurysm. We've been talking about early warning signs. This has been a primer, a 101 primer in how you can prevent the worst of a stroke from affecting you and happening, how you perhaps can prevent it, the things that you should do in order to minimize your risk factors. That said, if you, in fact, have a stroke, time is brain, and it's very important. I'm going to ask Dr. Malik a couple of more questions before we end. But if you're sorry you missed the beginning of the show, I have good news. We podcast. So tomorrow we will be up and running on the podcast platform. Just search OMG. I'm getting up. We will pop. Of course, if you're not a podcasting type, and I can understand that, we put it up on my website, Palm Beach. .comfortcare.com, palmbeach.comfortcare, comforcare.com. Don't put a T in there. Don't let spell check put a T in there. You'll never find us. palmbeach.comfortcare.com. Of course, if you'd like to listen to the show on a regular basis, I don't blame you. You can set a reminder on the TuneIn Radio app to listen to us on WSVU. Those are our call letters every Monday night at 6 o'clock live. Of course, we also simulcast www.TrueOldiesFLA.com. And we simulcast locally, around the country, and around the world. Next week, an interesting show, a show that I kind of can't wait for. Sylvia Gaddis will be here, and she's going to be talking about how those people on Medicare can advocate for better care and more attentive care. Sometimes we think we get what we get, and we don't advocate for ourselves or push for better options or more treatment. So most people, frankly, just surrender and do what they're told. But that doesn't have to be the case. Sylvia is an expert on a program called KEPRO, K-E-P-R-O, and that is an advocacy program to allow you to get the most from your Medicare. It's really, really interesting. In 2 weeks, it's Memorial Day, and like you, I'm going to be by the pool with a cocktail. But we will record rebroadcasting one of our favorite shows, so we'll still be here. And in 3 weeks, we're going to be talking about HIPAA. Not everybody understands what HIPAA is and is not. It's a really interesting subject. Remember, if you'd like to hear more from me about this aging highway that we travel down, I will be at Regency Park in Vero Beach this Thursday at noon. And I encourage you to come, and we will be doing our 5-week workshop at Barrington Terrace for those with family members with Alzheimer's and dementia starting June 1st. Dr. Malik, I haven't given everybody the opportunity to reach out to you. How is the best way for people to reach out to you and your team?
Hopefully they don't need to, but really the most important thing is if you think you're having a stroke, 911, you need to call for help. And it's good for you to know what your local institutions are, what hospitals are around you, which ones are comprehensive stroke centers. You can go to the hospital websites. My institution is St. Mary's Medical Center, and you can go to the website and do a Google search for that. And they have actually a webpage regarding strokes. The office that I work out of is Palm Beach Neuroscience Institute, which is another tenant facility, and the phone number for that is 561-882-6214. Mind you, most of my practice is emergencies, and I'm not somebody that typically sees patients in a clinic type environment, but I would strongly recommend, if you want to educate yourself more, is go to the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association websites, and there's a ton of useful information there.
So I can't thank you enough for being here again. You've been a guest before. You are gracious with your time. You are more than gracious with your information. You're a wonderful resource and a wealth of information. You probably did save a life tonight somewhere, I have no doubt. And so I can't thank you enough for being here again.
It's my pleasure.
I always love having you as a guest, and I hope I will twist your arm one more time. Maybe next May we'll get another Stroke Awareness Month. But you're great, and I thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
For you who are listening, this is Scott Greenberg. Oh, my God, I'm getting older. So is my mom. We are here, if you're a new listener, every Monday night talking about issues that confront boomers and their parents. We run the gamut. We talk about all sorts of things, none more important than, by the way, tonight's show was. We're here Mondays on 95.9 FM, True Oldies Florida, True Oldies FLA, 106.9 FM on the Treasure Coast. We rebroadcast on Long Island every Wednesday night at 103.9 Long Island's Talk Radio. And, of course, we rebroadcast again here on Sunday mornings, very early, bright and early, 7 a.m. But if you're up that early and listening, that's great. We're on, as I said, the iTunes podcast platform. We are on my website. We're on TuneIn Radio. We simulcast. We're on iHeartRadio. You can even shout at Alexa or Echo to pick us up. You can get us there. 95.9 and 106.9, True Oldies Florida, is now the number one rated radio station amongst adult listeners. That means you. That means me, which is why, oh, my God, I'm getting older, and so is my mom is here every Monday night. We're glad that you were with us tonight. We hope to see you again next week. I want to thank again my guest, Dr. Malik, for the wonderful and important information. And to the rest of you, have a great week. Oh, for all your moms yesterday, I hope you had a great Mother's Day as well. To the rest of you, have a great week. We'll see you next Monday. Oh, my God, I'm getting older, and so is my mom. Good night, all.